Okay, well, thank you very much for having me. And again, it's in competition with the banquet, so and especially the bar, so I can't talk for too long. But Bill's done a lot for us, certainly a lot for me in my not so recent move anymore. But not the least of it is to provide an occasion to have a very nice and actually very productive get together such as this, which I've been really enjoying, especially not being on the organizing committee. Okay, that's my title. That was not so in focus. So let's go. I thought I was getting it on the Fresnel lines, but I guess they're a little bit underneath in this. Yeah. There they are. Looks okay. That's cool. That's cool. Yeah. Okay, and my job today is to really, I don't want to go into detail, or not too much detail, but I want to tell you about Hamiltonian PDE and about applying analytic methods of Hamiltonian mechanics in to PDE, that is, in infinite dimensional phase spaces. So let me start by saying, let me tell you what I mean by Hamiltonian PDE. V is going to live in a function space, which I've called my phase space, and I'm just for convenience, I'll make it a Hilbert space. I think this is running out of juice, and this is the button. Look at that. Oh yeah, it's very faint. Better for me to point. Oh, here's a pointer. I'll point with something physical. V is in a function space. I'm going to call it H. This is just great generalities. I'll give specifics. In fact, half my talk is examples. And I want the evolution of V to be given by a right-hand side, which is a PDE, or could be other things, but I'm interested in the case of a PDE, which is in the form J, variation of a functional capital H. And I want to give it initial data V naught in that phase space. So I think the phase space is a Hilbert space, maybe Hilbert or a Banach manifold. And J is some reference to a symplectic form, which I don't want to talk about too much other than you can give it by an operator, J inverse and the inner product of the Hilbert space. And I need it to be skew adjoint. And then I'll talk about the flow. We want to think of this as a dynamical system, so the flow is going to be phi. So you are really making curves, your solutions are curves in that phase space, who, when you're at time t equals zero, you want to hit that point v in the phase space. And now my contents are, I want to talk about Hamiltonian PDE examples. I want to talk about, that'll show us why we want to look at invariant, why it's natural to talk about invariant tori, and also what some other natural questions. I'm going to pose the problem of finding solutions of this form actually as a variational problem. Not that it helps, but I thought it has a certain elegance. I'm going to switch these last two around. I'm going to have a last slide. These are could be a little technical, so I'm just going to make a little list, and just so people who are in the audience feel they got, who need credit feel they got credit. And what I will do is a little bit of technical detail just to show you one method for doing this. Those estimates of the linearized operator, and that has a certain charm to it. So let's start with examples. So principal example today, and maybe one of my principal examples, is simply a nonlinear wave equation. This is a little bit artificial physically because most of the time the wave equations you derive in a physical problem aren't so simple and depend on more derivatives of u that of your solution u than this, but it's at least a good starting point. And I want to, so dt squared u minus Laplacian u plus some nonlinearity, that has to equal zero. And let's see where x should be. Most of the time, I mean, it's already hard enough in one dimension. So td is a d-dimensional torus, but how about x just being on 0, 2 pi with periodic boundary conditions? You could also put it with Dirichlet boundary conditions, and if you need, on possible other domains, if we can do the work. This is a Hamiltonian system, as per the previous slide. Here is the Hamiltonian function. You introduce another function, p, and the Hamiltonian function is a half the L2 norm of p plus the H1 half, the H1 norm of u plus capital G. And capital G is such that you take a u derivative, you get little g. And then this wave equation has the form of, it's a nice, simple, but a nice way to write it as a first order system. U dot is equal to p, that's the p variation of h. And P dot is equal to Laplacian U minus the U derivative of capital G, which is minus the U variation of H. And of course, the system has this form. The U dot is equal to J, the variation of H, where J is equal to I and minus I. That means it's written in Darboux coordinates. So let me just say this again. U dot is equal to the P variation of H using this, which is P, and P dot is equal to, likewise, minus the U variation of H. Well, let's carry on with this example, just to do simple things. Let's just say that G has a Taylor expansion. And let's pretend it has no linear term. That means there's no constant term in the equation. So it starts, constants don't matter in Hamiltonian since you're busy differentiating them. So start with the quadratic term, cubic, higher. Then, of course, H has an expansion. It's H2, H3, and higher because we're making a Taylor expansion of one of its components, the other being all quadratic. And this is a Taylor expansion I remind you about. V is my point in phase space, which is UP equals 0. An elegant way to linearize, again, completely simple, is take the quadratic part of the Hamiltonian around 0. 0 is a stationary point with this hypothesis. And I'm going to use the Poincaré theorem that in some appropriate basis, I can write this simply in terms of sums of squares of the coefficients of eigenmodes, where I'm going to choose to expand the UP vector in terms of UK PK vectors times eigenfunctions, and those are eigenfunctions of the linearized operator, the spatial part of the linearized operator. So this is the right-hand side of the linear part at zero of the wave equation. The frequencies are omega k squared. The eigenvalues are omega k squared. They are frequencies. Let's pretend they're all positive. And my point in doing this is it's a harmonic oscillator. It's infinite dimensional harmonic oscillator with frequencies omega k. And that's simple, but that's the attitude I want to preserve. And let's just solve it. So solve that wave equation, but only put in H2, so I'm solving the linearized equation. So I'm at zero, I'm looking at the solutions in the tangent space. And that's equation 3. And let's just write all down all the solutions in terms of their eigenfunction expansions. Sorry, I ran over the slide here. But I have initial data for U0, K, and P0, K, those initial values of the components in the modes. And then I have oscillation with frequency omega K, sums over the eigenmodes. And that's the linear flow. I put in capital phi. So let's just go through the facts. The Hamiltonian is preserved by the flow. That's what a Hamiltonian system should be, and in this linear case, it's also true. And non-linear case, it should be true, at least for the good orbits. And not only that, but the actions are preserved by the flow. So if I do the following thing, I take square of the U component times omega k, and 1 over omega k is the square of the P component. That's called ik, and the linear flow preserves those. What changes are the angles. The angles move linearly in time, as you can easily see from that expression of the solution of the linearized equations, and then just by looking, all solutions are periodic. Well, they would be periodic if any active frequency, that is any U0K, P0K that I choose to be non-zero, that frequency has the form of an integer times some basic frequency. And then all solutions are periodic. But it could be you have finitely many coefficients non-zero, but their frequencies aren't related. Then aren't rationally related. Then it would be quasi-periodic. And the general case for sort of a generic system with a bunch of generic frequencies, a typical solution will be almost periodic with all frequencies active. Okay, so it would be if no finite number of frequencies suffice, or at least no finite number of base frequencies can be used to describe all the omega k's. So here are the basic questions for the nonlinear problem, because those are the simple facts of life, the linear problem. And those go as follows. Whether any of the solutions of the nonlinear problem have the same properties of, can you find periodic ones, quasi-periodic ones, or almost periodic ones? Periodic is classic. Quasi-periodic, I guess, counts for isotropic or lower dimensional tori, and almost periodic, at least it has enough frequencies, you're trying to create Lagrangian invariant tori for the problem. That's like KAM theory. I want to talk about that today. But you can also talk about other facts about flow for a PDE. If you start in a ball, you have to it's possibly careful choice of the Hilbert phase space, but if you start in a ball, does the flow keep you in the ball twice the radius, say, or n times the radius for finite time or maybe for all time? That's a well-posedness question, an appropriate choice of function space question. But as I said, the linear problem left the actions invariant and only moved the angles. So a question, a more sophisticated version of this would be, does the nonlinear equation move the actions? And by how much over what time? So that's like a Nikoroshev stability question. For example, find me a time t of epsilon such that for t is less than t of epsilon, starting in the ball radius 2r, the actions don't change by more than, say, epsilon to the alpha. And in finite dimensions, that can be exponentially long. And in infinite dimensions, sometimes in some neighborhoods, you could prove this. In other cases, in possibly larger neighborhoods, you might have polynomial bounds. And then what's really much more terra incognita is, what's the analog of Arnold diffusion? This bound is an upper bound on Arnold diffusion. Are there lower bounds? Can you force solutions to grow? And that is an interesting question. The only answers I know of are by a very few things and slightly in a few situations by Sergei Kuksin. Let me just finish my examples. Nonlinear Schrodinger equation. It's a little bit different, but still Hamiltonian system. I d beta t u minus half plus nu plus some nonlinear function q, depends on u and u bar, equals zero. Let's put x on a torus again, even just on a circle in one dimension is fine. We take initial data in some appropriate function space. We want to look at the flow that has Hamiltonian, which is kinetics plus potential energy, you can say. To do quantum mechanics, you need g to be real valued, and then q is the dz bar derivative of g. And if we pose that h, then the equation 4 can be written as u dot is equal to j u bar derivative of the Hamiltonian h. Remember, u is complex. J is given by I, by multiplication by complex unit I. That's not quite Darboux coordinates. It's almost. It's complex symplectic coordinates. KdV equation is similar. It's forced to be in R1 because it's a little bit artificial in higher dimensions. It has the Hamiltonian, and J turns out to be a little bit more non-classical. It is given by a derivative. Still, it's skew adjoint operator, and not too degenerate. And then there are other things that I wanted to exhibit, but I don't really have time. A little bit in the spirit of the talk of Gérard Jos, you can talk about waves in interfaces or in surfaces. Those turn out to be Hamiltonian systems as well. And I'll just put this slide on to say the Hamiltonian sometimes can look a little complicated and maybe even bizarre, but those occur as well. Let me skip a couple slides. So let's go back to doing something about invariant tori. So I'm going to look for the following. An invariant torus is a torus sitting in a Hilbert space that is invariant on the flow. So let's look at S being a mapping of a torus, an M-dimensional torus. For a periodic solution of M would be 1, say. M-dimensional torus, and it could be infinite, maybe. But let's take M-dimensional torus into Hilbert space, and I want it to be flow invariant, but actually I want more than flow invariance. I want linear flow on the torus at frequency capital omega to be mapped to the flow given by the PDE. So that says that mapping has to do the following thing. If I move angle by t omega, where omega is an m vector, then that corresponds to flowing in the phase space by time t. Omega is the frequency, and this relation implies that a time derivative has to be j, the variation of h of s. That's what has to happen all of that mapping. But of course, t and c are related on such linear flows by this. So to solve equation 8, and then here's the relation. What relation has this to this conference? That's a bifurcation problem with bifurcation parameters omega, which sit in Rm. So omega is a bifurcation parameter, and the solution involves find s, find omega. That's generally, the problem is generally a small divisor problem. even for periodic solutions, for a PDE, it's very often a small divisor problem. And I'll just rewrite 8 by taking J inverse. If I'm in Darboux coordinates, J inverse is minus J, and write it as this, then the linearization will be self-adjoint. So it's a variational problem. Let me state it so it looks a little bit more like that. So back to mappings. Consider a space of mappings, S, so all possible mappings. I'm going to call all possible mappings X, and we're going to need a topology, but I'm not going to talk about it today. I'm going to need another hour, another half hour. So look at all possible, like if M were 1, I'm looking at all possible circles. That's a loop space. Well, this is a torus space, all possible mappings of a torus into my Hilbert space. And on each one, I'm going to assume the topology of X is such that on each one, I can define the following functionals. In particular, I'm going to have actions. Well, you know, on a circle or on a curve, there's one action, integral of PDQ. But if you map a torus of dimension M, there's M many actions. I want you to define those, too. So the jth action is S Hilbert space inner product J inverse D by DC J S. And J is, so I is going to be a vector with components, these IJs. And let me note that the variation of IJ is this J inverse DCJS that appeared in my equation 8. I also want to define the average Hamiltonian H bar of S. So that's the average of H over the mapping of the torus, whose variation is the gradient of H. And consider the subvariety of X. Look at all of X, but look at the subvariety of X where I constrain the action. So the first action I want to be A1, the mth action I want to be AM. That's some M codimensional subset of X, still infinite dimensional. And the variational problem is find critical points of H bar on M. A can change, so M can change, but for A fixed. And that then you use the Lagrange multiplier rule. And that's an omega to the Lagrange multiplier. And it'd be nice to have those, and it'd be nice to count those. And I want you to also note that if I change the origin, I's are invariant because I'm averaging over the torus. H bar is invariant, so I'm averaging over the torus, and certainly MA is invariant. So the whole problem has, so the I's are invariant under the torus action, and so the Euler-Lagrange equations are going to be equivariant with respect to that group. And that helps, although I won't really talk about it, in finding, counting, getting lower bounds the number of critical points by Morse type of theories. The two questions are, do critical points exist? That functional omega dot d by dc is pretty degenerate, and the h doesn't usually help. How do you understand multiplicity? Once you have that, you have possibly resonant tori. So we want to know a little bit about what that ma is, mod group action. And the answer is, well, very fast. What do you do? There are small divisors. Typically, you want to recover your equilibrium with Nash-Moser method, make up for what you lose in solving a linearized problem. And in doing that, in this case, well, at least me and my co-author in numerous papers, Gene Wayne, use Froehlich-Spencer estimates, kind of an interesting playoff between random quantum mechanics or random field theory and KAM theory. And then when to count this multiplicity, too, is there's a Morse-Bott theory of critical points when there's a group action. So it's bifurcation theory. I have to talk about the linearized problem. So I linearize, I look at the tangent space. H2 was a linear combination of the actions. Remember, V is QP, and I'm going to look at linearized around 0. I want to look at these mappings, and I expanded in X. But to be fair with everybody, I should also expand in the eigenfunctions on the torus. So I'm going to expand in complex exponentials as well, and I get coefficients, XJK, which describe the mapping. And there's that equation 8, linearized, is an equation for SJK. When I untangle it, it looks like this. How do you linearize something which involves a variation? You take the second variation, and you just evaluate that at 0, and you get a 2x2 block diagonal matrix with diagonal 2x2 elements, looks like that, who have eigenvalues this. And some will be zero and others will not. And generally, the sad fact is, they're dense on the line. You have a bunch of zeros and otherwise they're dense on the line. It's very simple and very classical fact. So what you want to do is identify what is your eigenspace and try to deal with the rest. So choose a base frequency around which you're going to perturb. That's your bifurcation point. And you want it to choose it to pick out a certain number of modes, your omega KLs and JLs, L equals 1 to M because you're looking for an M torus, and that identifies a null space, and you're going to divide up your considerations as what's in the null space, what's not. I'm just saying bifurcation theory to you. And so X1 is a particular interest, those are the null space, could be infinite dimensional, but in any case, it has to be symplectic, that's why it's even dimensional. And the non-resonant case is when it's exactly 2M, when you've chosen M frequencies, and otherwise it could be bigger, those are resonant tori. And the other eigenvalues are the ones that are non-zero. They certainly can accumulate at zero, but they're mostly non-zero. And then decompose your problem with respect to them. It just sounds very familiar, doesn't it? So the space of mappings, decompose into what's in the null space, that's Q of X. I'll call that X1, as I did last time. Everything else, call it X2, and then decompose your functionals. What's the Q? That's the bifurcation equation. Finite, maybe infinite dimensional. You have to treat them a little gingerly in both cases. Infinite dimensional, a little more gingerly. And then P, that's the rest. Often, just solve it in bifurcation theory. Here, I'm sorry, it's a small divisor problem. You pay a lot of attention to that. In fact, most of the attention to that. But that's analysis. Of course, you decompose the mapping, parts of the mapping as well. There's the S1, which is you'll solve later, S2, which you'll solve now, and try to get S2 a function of the parameters. And dating from the Weinstein-Moser approach to the resonant Lyapunov center theorem, actually, you can solve the Q equation as a reduced variational problem. So since it was just a few slides ago that I said there's a variational problem, replace all those things that I said by the following. Replace IJs by IJ1s. Ones means it's on X1, not on X. So maybe finite dimensional, or if it's infinite dimensional, at least it's reduced, where you just plug in S1 plus S2, where S2 depends these parameters. And H-bar 1, the same thing. And MA1 is MA, but sliced, basically, by the null space, because you evaluate the IJ1s on these, what people have said is slaved variables. And that is possibly finite dimensional, or at least reduced, and has topology. And you try to, and the statement is, if you find critical points of this problem, and you've already solved the P problem, then you have solutions.
So,
this is assuming to solve the P problem, then you try to solve this. And the sad fact is, you solve the P problem on Cantor sets, so you say, assuming you solve the P problem, then you solve this, and you try to get them to hit the Cantor sets. And that's a non-degeneracy estimate. But I won't really touch on that further. That's for when you have a drink. And what I'd like to do is just tell you what I find the most challenging part of this at this point. That's a sketch. I just want to say, how do you do the P equation? So let me tell you just a tiny bit about that. I have two slides. The second one was a picture, so it's only half a slide. And then I almost will stop. So the linearized operator, the trouble is, to do a Nash-Moser method, you need to linearize not about zero, but also about an approximate torus embedding. So you do this thing where you take the second variations of your equation, but you evaluate at S0 rather than at zero. And that's going to be that same old thing, this part, which is the evaluation at zero, plus error terms. And error terms have structure. And you have to look over all indices, JK, which index the modes on the torus and the modes in space. And what I'd like to say is there are small divisors, so what you do is you split up your considerations as to whether your divisors are small, smaller than D0, or not. So let's pretend that there are no small divisors. Then you can invert the linearized equation with that estimate. And then, so what you have to say is there are all these modes, And you have to mark them if they correspond to a small divisor. Everything else, you unmark and you can solve, so it's not a problem. So think of it this way. A is sets of labels of modes, and you can invert on A if it consists only of non-small divisor things. And then what you have to do is put back in, but you can't ignore those others. Those are part of the solution. You have to put them back in, and that's the Froelich-Spencer estimates. So I have one slide to explain that whole theory, which is about 20 years old this year, I think. I think their paper was 82, actually, so 21 years. So here's the idea. That second variation of my equation is really a diagonal part, which depends on omega, plus an off-diagonal part. And I took out the modes that are not bigger than, that have this eigenvalue bigger than d-naught. I put aside those are okay, those are in A. Now I look at the ones which are smaller than d-naught, but I can't look at them all. So I cut off by some vn. N is an artifice for this slide. There's an iteration, it's the nth iterate. Dn is going to go to zero exponentially as my iteration scheme goes on, but my correction each time is going to go super exponentially and we'll still win. But just think of it as a new parameter which is very small. And then I have resonant sites which I have to start adding in. So a y and a y prime are points in my lattice, those label modes. But my resonant sites which I have to add in at the nth step are outside a barrier of radius n. So here's the picture. This is the lattice, so I'm just labeling all modes. And points on this lattice are an A, that is okay, or they could be singular, the bad ones. And so I want to mark my bad ones. And here's what I'm going to do. Oh, here's what we need in order to proceed. If we have separation of the bad sites at scale n, then we can perform the estimates we need in order to proceed. So separation means you use it as you need, but it means to us that if you have a group of resonant sites which you're going to put together, then either they're close to each other, that is Rn to the epsilon, where epsilon is a very small number, so it's a little local cluster, or else the distance between, it's up to you to decide the clusters, but or else, if you're not in that cluster, you're very far away. So gamma is a reasonably large number, and this distance from here to there is Rn to a large number. So few resonant sites clumped in large distance, then you can proceed. That's Froelich-Spencer estimates. Actually, that's the hypothesis of Froelich-Spencer estimates. The way you do them, that's also for a drink. And let me just finish by saying, here's one slide with a series of results that people have obtained over the years. And in fact, I think this is 10 years old. No, more, 1988. My work on this is 10 years old this year. So for the nonlinear wave equation, there were two very nice papers, one by Kuksin. I think the Russian was 87 and the translation was 88. And Jean Wayne in Communications Pure Communications and Math Physics, 89. Studying the nonlinear wave equation, and it turns out resonance has something to do with what boundary conditions have. So they stuck with Dirichlet boundary conditions. And to make periodic boundary conditions, Jean and I wrote a paper in 1993. That was our first paper, I guess, together. And Bourguin picked this up, Jean Bourguin picked this up and wrote a series of papers, 94 and on, and he did a number of really remarkable technical additions to the theory, including making it possible to go to higher dimension and to higher dimensional tori. And separation is key and often imposed by Diophantine and other conditions. The NLS, a similar sequence of papers, is a very beautiful paper by Kuksin and Pushel in the Annals in 1996, which exhibited very clearly part of this, which is you get bifurcation curves. They're submanifolds of dimension M. But they're Cantor manifolds. They're holes in them where you had too many resonances. I didn't tell you what you did when it failed those hypotheses. You cut it out, as a good surgeon knows. Perturbations of KdV, again, Kuksin addressed that in his 1988 paper. But there's a very beautiful new book by Kapeller and Pushel on Springer. And some of the new things that I planned to have this year last year and this, actually, to be focused on small divisors in my life. And partially successful. So one of the things we are looking at is Birkhoff-Lewis orbits in the NLS equation. which again are periodic orbits of very long period, or actually periodic quasi-orbits of very long minimal period. And Gérard Jos reminded me that there's work on the water wave problem, that those two slides that I slipped by very fast, very recently involving periodic solutions, that is the standing wave problem. So there's a Plotnikov and Tolan paper in 2001, and an announcement by Jos, Plotnikov, and Tolan in the case H equals infinity, which corresponds to the infinite-dimensional null space, infinite-dimensional X1. That was rapid fire, but let's stop now.